Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 16th Saturday reading of the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Man who killed Aurora mom, daughter in 2022 head-on crash convicted of vehicular homicide by Kristen O. Sentinel, Colorado. Four takeaways from the rocky rollout of Colorado's popular new free preschool program by Ann Schmick, Colorado Chalkbee. Williams takes oath despite student community concerns by Elizabeth Slay. Centennial leaders host community event on District 1 by Taylor Shaw. Douglas County Health Department warns residents to check pantries for recalled applesauce by Ellis Arnold. Cherry Creek Superintendent addresses racist videos in Letter to Families by Taylor Shaw. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Man who killed Aurora mom, daughter in 2020 head-on crash convicted of vehicular homicide. An Aurora man accused of driving drunk last year and causing a head-on crash that killed a mother and her daughter was convicted yesterday of vehicular homicide and a host of additional charges, according to prosecutors. Juan Pablo Pascual Lucia, 32, was found guilty on multiple charges after he killed two people in one family and critically injured two more, according to a statement from the 18th Judicial District Attorney's Office. The jury deliberated for less than 2 hours before returning guilty verdicts for two counts of vehicular homicide, two counts of vehicular assault, and one count of child abuse, knowingly, recklessly causing serious bodily injury. In the blink of an eye, a family is torn apart by the selfish actions of someone who chose to drive drunk and endanger multiple lives. Senior Deputy D.A. Megan Galo said in the statement, "As a mother, I cannot imagine the heartbreak, grief, and devastation this family has suffered. It was a privilege to prosecute this case and bring justice to this family." On April 8, 2022, a family of four, including a mom, dad, a 10-year-old son, and a 6-year-old daughter, were driving back home after celebrating the daughter's birthday. Pascual Lucia was driving more than 80 miles per hour in the wrong direction on Chambers Road when he collided with the family's car, according to the press release. The crash occurred near East 6th Avenue. The son and his father suffered serious injuries, but they ultimately survived. The mother and the daughter were pronounced dead at the hospital. Investigators with the Aurora Police Department discovered that Pascual Lucia also hit a bicyclist and then nearly hit a group of teenagers in a crosswalk, according to the release. Pascual Lucia's blood alcohol level was reported at being 0.181, more than double the legal limit, when it was tested nearly an hour after the crash. There is no excuse or justification for the defendant's egregious actions that night, Senior Deputy D.A. Doug Betchell said in the press release. A father woke up several days later in a hospital bed, only to learn his wife and daughter were dead and his son would have to learn how to walk again. Their lives are forever changed based on the defendant's inexcusable behavior to drive drunk. Pascual Lucia is scheduled to be sentenced on February 15th. Four takeaways from the rocky rollout of Colorado's popular new free preschool program. Denver. With its new universal preschool program, Colorado joins a small but growing group of states that offer tuition-free preschool to all four-year-olds. So far, the program is popular with families, but there have been lots of bumps in the road, including three lawsuits against the state and the threat of a fourth. Some of the hiccups and headaches are usually new program fare, while others stem from the program's rushed rollout by a new state agency. Despite the problems, the $322 million program is a big deal. Funded partly with a nicotine tax that Colorado voters passed easily, it's cutting preschool tuition costs for thousands of families and helping more Colorado children get ready for kindergarten. Nearly 50,000 preschoolers are enrolled this year, more than double the number served in the state's previous smaller preschool program. Universal preschool has long been one of Governor Jared Polis's signature initiatives, and its launch last August represents the second and harder half of the governor's ambitious early childhood agenda. Free full-day kindergarten, which kicked off in 2019, was the other major component. Here's a closer look at four key issues that have cropped up during the preschool program's first 6 months. A surge in demand led to tough decisions, and could again. More than 38,000 four-year-olds, 60% of that age group in the state, are enrolled in universal preschool this year. That's about 8,000 more four-year-olds than the state expected. In addition, the program includes more than 10,000 three-year-olds with risk factors. The surge in demand meant state officials had to spread the money more thinly than planned. Last summer, just weeks before preschool was set to start, they told thousands of families that their children wouldn't get free full-day preschool, only half-day, because there wasn't enough funding. Some of the students who lost out, low-income students and English language learners, are those who stand to benefit the most from extra preschool. The state has already taken steps to remedy this program for about 3,000 children next year, specifically those living in poverty. A proposed rule would prioritize these four-year-olds for full-day classes. At the same time, the state expects even more four-year-olds, as much as 64% of that group, to enroll in universal preschool next year. With next year's state budget not yet set, the possibility of another surge in demand and a slew of new rules under consideration, it's unclear how far the money will go. State leaders promised high-quality preschool. It will take years. One of the casualties in the race to stand up the new preschool program were rules governing program quality. State officials ran out of time to craft those rules, so they told participating preschools last year to keep doing what you're doing. This means preschools are required to meet only basic health and safety standards this year, not other benchmarks of quality such as small class sizes, highly trained teachers, and strong curriculum. Some participating preschools already embrace high-quality practices, but not all do. That leaves the current universal preschool landscape a mishmash of superior programs, mediocre programs, and everything in between. Experts say quality standards matter because when preschool is done well, it can have short and long-term benefits for children, boosting academic skills, increasing the likelihood of graduating from high school, and even improving adult job and health outcomes. Colorado officials are planning to adopt some quality rules for the 2024 to 2025 school year and a separate set of rules on preschool staff credentials for the 2025 to 2026 school year. But with some likely to be phased in over time, four or more classes of universal preschools may graduate from the program before a binding set of quality requirements take hold. Colorado faces lawsuits as church-state legal landscape changes. Although faith-based preschools make up a tiny fraction of Colorado's universal preschool providers, they've played an outsized role in recent legal challenges over the program's policies. Two of three lawsuits the state is facing over universal preschool revolve around a non-discrimination agreement state officials asked participating preschools to sign. The agreement bans discrimination based on various factors, including religion, sexual orientation, and gender identity. But a Christian preschool in Chaffee County and two Catholic preschools in Metro Denver sued over the provision last summer. In October, a federal judge blocked Colorado from withholding universal preschool funds or disciplining the Chaffee County preschool, even though its policies on employee hiring and bathroom and pronoun use appear to violate the non-discrimination clause. The lawsuit by the Catholic preschools, which is set to go to trial in early January, is broader. Like the Chaffee County case, it takes issue with the possibility of hiring staff who don't reflect the school's religious tenets, but it also challenges the state's mandate to accept all children and families regardless of religion, sexual orientation, and gender identity. The schools argue that enrolling all children conflicts with their religious beliefs and mission to provide a Catholic education. There's likely another battle over religion on the horizon. That's because of a proposal to ban religious instruction during universal preschool classes starting next fall. The state intended to put that ban into place from the outset, but didn't follow through, allowing participating faith-based preschools to incorporate religion however they see fit this year. That omission set Colorado up for a conspicuous midstream flip-flop. The conservative group Advance Colorado has already threatened to sue if the state goes through with the proposed ban, citing a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision allowing public funding for religion education. Class size debate is another symptom of funding challenges. This year, universal preschool classes can have up to 24 four-year-olds. That's higher than most early childhood experts recommended, so the state has proposed capping the number at 20 starting next fall. A related rule would require one staff member for every 10 children, down from 1 per 12 this year. But some participating preschools literally banked on having 24 students per class and 12 students per staff member. The state pays about $6,000 per child for half-day preschool. If the proposed changes are adopted, these providers stand to lose tens of thousands of dollars next year, and some have said they would pull out of the program altogether. The class size dilemma, especially in a field known for razor-thin margins and low pay, is another example of the tension between Colorado's promise of high-quality preschool for all and the reality of limited funding. Although universal preschool's $322 million price tag sounds like a hefty sum, preschool providers, school districts, and lawmakers have questioned whether it's enough to support the program Colorado leaders envisioned. Three-alarm Aurora apartment construction blaze destroys five vacant units Thursday. A total of five apartment units were destroyed in the fire. No injuries were reported. By Kristen O., Sentinel, Colorado. Nearly two dozen of Aurora Fire Rescue units responded to a report of a three-alarm fire early Thursday at a southeast Aurora apartment construction site. The fire was reported at approximately midnight at a construction site for an apartment building near the 7300 block of South Addison Court. Officials said there were few fire hydrants in the area because it is a new construction site, and first responders had to work around the construction equipment, according to a press release the fire department released Thursday afternoon. First responders fought the fire from the E-470 interstate on the east side, as well on the west and north sides of the site. A total of five apartment units were destroyed in the fire. No injuries were reported. The investigation remains open. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives will assist with the investigation by supplying heavy equipment that will be helpful in digging out the debris and determining the origin and cause, according to the press release. Offense for the defense. Aurora public defenders take the stand. As the Aurora City Council prepares to finalize its bidding process for private lawyers to take over the work of the Public Defender's Office, opponents both inside and outside of the city have begun campaigning against the change, saying privatization would jeopardize the legal rights of Aurora's poorest residents. The council finalized details of the requests for proposals, known as RFP, at its December 11th study session, with critics insisting the city do more to ensure any analysis takes in a wide range of considerations. At the group's last meeting, public defenders and others again showed up during the opening public comment period to protest privatization. It's disheartening as a resident to hear that the city's elected officials don't seem to take their constitutional duties to provide good and effective assistance of counsel to our neighbors as something to be defended and to be held precious, said Tasha Stewart, a chief public defender in Aurora who said she was speaking on her own behalf on December 4th. Supporters of the item have stressed that the council's vote on October 9th was not a commitment to eliminating the office, but only a request for bids to see if private lawyers can do the work of public defense more cheaply. Opponents, in the meantime, have described the move as a calculated first step toward reducing the quality of legal representation offered to poor defendants. I don't know what people are so afraid of with doing this RFP, Councilmember Dustin Zvonik said November 27th, when the RFP was challenged during a discussion about the city's 2024 budget. If they're so confident that it's going to show that there is no savings, then let's just hurry up and get it done so that we can move on with this. But my assumption is that they're fearful that it will, in fact, show a significant cost savings, and that will lead to us having the responsibility of asking the question of whether or not we should go to a contract basis. Zvonik is sponsoring the search for alternatives to Aurora's Public Defender's Office, a proposal that so far has earned the support of council conservatives and the consternation of progressives, public defenders, and outside attorneys. The office is slated to have an operating budget of about $2.26 million out of a general fund budget of about $508.79 million in 2024. Last fall, a subcommittee of the Citizens Advisory Budget Committee also suggested that the city look into handing the work of public defense over to outside attorneys. This week, critics told city lawmakers that a preliminary internal analysis offered to lawmakers earlier this year estimated an approximate $1 million in annual city savings by essentially privatizing the public defender unit. Chief Public Defender Elizabeth Cadas said the document is fraught with errors. "This is not a study," Cadas said Monday. Juno Scott, the chairman of the committee, who also ran unsuccessfully for city council this year, said at the time that Aurora should look into how other municipal courts in Colorado satisfy the constitutional requirement that defendants facing jail time have access to a lawyer. To qualify for public defense in Aurora, defendants generally can make no more than $1,519 per month for a single-family household. A family of four under the federal court guidelines can make no more than $3,125 per month, according to Aurora Public Defender Office officials. Cadas said her staff can appeal the limits for applicants who are near the thresholds, perhaps by a few hundred dollars. Scott specifically mentioned Colorado Springs, which pays private attorneys flat fees for 2 hours of work on each case assigned to them, as an alternative. "All of those other cities, are they on to something?" Scott asked in 2022. "We need public defenders. We're not suggesting to get rid of public defense. That's constitutional. That's something we need. But what we're asking is, can it be done in a more efficient way?" Then, Chief Public Defender Doug Wilson said he did not believe Colorado Springs was comparable, as that city's court does not handle the serious and complex cases sometimes heard in Aurora's municipal court. While the city council majority expressed its support for analyzing the cost of the change, that analysis was either not done nor was rolled into a larger workload study. The topic came up again at a budget workshop in September. In October, the council's conservative majority voted to move forward with a request for proposals. Conservatives said at the time that they would weigh the services offered by bidders against the work that is currently done by the Public Defender's Office. But public defenders and other council members said they were worried indigent defendants will slip through the cracks if their cases are left to attorneys who are incentivized to wrap things up quickly with a plea deal. "It's a big risk to take," Cadas said October 9th. "Your decision will, in fact, affect an entire department full of full-time employees who work here and are good at what they do and are providing a constitutionally required service to this city." The council's vote on October 9th may have set the request for proposal in motion, but criticism of the proposal has continued, with council members taking the opportunity of recent votes on the budget to express their concerns. "This was done for vindictive reasons," then Councilmember Juan Marcano said November 27th. We had members of the Public Defender's Office, including our former Chief Public Defender, come out against some of the policy proposals that Councilmember Zvonik brought forward. This has nothing to do with good government. It has everything to do with political retribution. Zvonik said Marcano's allegations about his motives were untrue. Last month, Councilmember Allison Combs hosted a forum at City Hall, inviting legal experts to weigh in on the proposal and other communities' experiences privatizing public defense. Speakers said the two most common models for a privatized system either result in higher costs for cities, such as when private attorneys are paid per hour of time spent on a case, or lackluster representation for poor defendants, specifically when lawyers are paid a predetermined amount per case regardless of the amount of work they do. If you're doing it to cut costs, then you're doing it to undercut the indigent defense function, said Eve Primus, a professor of law at the University of Michigan. If you do it in a way that is designed to provide constitutionally adequate representation, it will wind up costing more than an institutional public defender because those systems are just less efficient and less effective. She brought up how the American Bar Association in the 1980s raised concerns about cities bidding out public defender services because of the incentive for lawyers to reduce service to the lowest level in order to obtain a contract, according to the association. Speakers also talked about other benefits of having an in-house office, like having attorneys who know how to navigate specialty courts that divert offenders to social services rather than prison, and who are familiar with patterns of unprofessional behavior by police and prosecutors. Private defense attorney Casey Crisman told city lawmakers at the December 4th meeting that private practice defenders don't want indigent cases. Crisman previously worked in the Aurora Public Defender Office. The citizens of Aurora need to know that this proposal is not in their best interest, Crisman said. The experienced lawyers in the Public Defender Office are much more effective than any plan that includes contract attorneys would be. Crisman said navigating the city's notorious bureaucracy and process is facilitated by a regular defense team and an impediment to a good defense by naive newcomer attorneys. Last year, the Public Defender's Office uncovered a years-long failure by the city's attorney's office to notify defense attorneys when police officers with demonstrated credibility issues were involved in criminal cases, which CU law professor Ann England speculated after the forum could be motivating council members sympathetic to prosecutors to try to outsource public defense. Among those present at the November 15th forum were CADAs, Councilmember Allison Combs, and Tom Tobiasen, chairperson of the Aurora Public Defender Commission, which oversees the city office. The commission has since come out to formally oppose the city's request for proposal, writing in a December 4th letter to the council that multiple studies have shown that privatized models tend to be more expensive when considering how often defendants under those models are incarcerated and how long it takes for their cases to make it through the court system. Due to efficiencies of scale and the quality of representation provided, the Aurora Public Defender's Office is considered a model for other large municipal public defender's offices around the country, the letter states, mentioning how the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association recognized the office in 2021 as a model municipal court public defense system. The debate has drawn the attention of state lawmakers and advocacy groups critical of the council's decision, including the American Civil Liberties Union, which said in a social media post that privatizing public defense would allow other elements of the city's criminal justice system to operate without any accountability or transparency. State Rep. Mike Weissman, Democrat Aurora, last week stressed that providing high-quality legal representation for defendants also benefits crime victims by preventing defendants from appealing a guilty verdict on the grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel. Everybody else in the criminal legal system, and frankly the broader community, should also have an interest in robust, indigent defense, Weissman said. No survivor of crime wants a protracted process in terms of appeals and so forth. So we should be mindful of things that might tend to draw things out, and not having the best defense that we can in the first instance is going to be prone to draw that out. Still, conservatives have insisted critics have been prematurely jumping to conclusions about what the council would decide and what impacts a shift toward private attorneys handling public defense would have. This is being made into a constitutional rights violation, like we're trying to do away with public defenders altogether, Councilmember Danielle Jurinski said November 13th. There are multiple cities that have private defense. All this is an RFP. That's all it is. Williams takes oath despite student community concerns. Two people were sworn in as newly elected Inglewood School Board members on December 5th. One was Katie Wilberding Cross, a social worker and school volunteer, and the other was Devon Williams, a twice-convicted felon who is facing a pending car theft accusation from 2019. Williams, who ran unopposed for a four-year term on the school board, has an appearance on bond set for 8:30 a.m. on December 6th in Adams County Court Division 6 in Brighton. During the meeting, Williams was made secretary of the board. Wilberding Cross was made president. Julie Hogue was made first vice president. Dwayne Tucker was made second vice president. And Steve LaFleur was made treasurer. Community members expressed concern regarding Williams in the lead-up to the November 7th election after the Inglewood Herald reported that he had an active arrest warrant in the ongoing court case, two felon convictions, and a litigious hits history, including suing the city. The Glendale Police Department confirmed that Williams turned himself in to their agency on November 6th for the outstanding warrant. Williams declined to comment at both the December 5th board meeting and a December 4th city council meeting. Students speak out. Inglewood High School senior and student journalist Michael Marquay spoke at the December 5th meeting about his concerns regarding the situation. I believe there needs to be more regulations in place for the protection of our students, Marcus said. We want to ensure a transparent, legal, and thorough vetting process for not only our district, but the rest of the school districts through the state of Colorado. Marquay interviewed Williams for the Pirate TV broadcast, Walk the Plank, in early October, before the Inglewood Herald reported on Williams' criminal history. My first impression of Devon Williams was overwhelmingly positive, Marquay said in an email interview with the Herald. I felt he was passionate about the ideals of diversity, equity, and inclusion for all within the district, as well as he had some great answers to our questions during the podcast. The 18-year-old said he was shocked when the Inglewood Herald initially reported on Williams' background. I felt uneasy as he had been president on a TEC, the Inglewood campus, middle school, and high school campus with a felony arrest warrant, Marquay said. However, my uneasiness quickly turned to curiosity, which led me to research the current laws in place as well as the Inglewood Schools Board of Education's policies on what makes an eligible candidate. State Representative weighs in. State Representative Meg Froelich, Democrat, Arapahoe County, attended the December 5th school board meeting, and she said she admires Marquay for addressing the board. As he said, we need to balance the safety of our students with our First Amendment rights, Froelich said. Currently, the law states in CRS 22-31-129, a school director office shall be deemed to be vacant upon the occurrence of any one of the following events prior to the expiration of the term of office. E. If the person who was duly elected or appointed is found guilty of a felon, so perhaps this matter will be resolved in the ensuing months if a felony conviction occurs. Additionally, Froelich said she will address the matter with Englewood residents. I'll continue to listen to our community and to look into increasing the requirements to run for school board, Froelich said. At a minimum, we could update the disclosure forms that people fill out. I believe voters deserve both information and choices. Marquay said he admires Williams for facing his active arrest warrant and going to the Glendale police. I think Williams did a good job turning himself in, opting to address his current pending situation, and not continuing to run and leave the voters completely in the dark, Marquay said. The high school student said he is worried about Williams' participation on the board. I have some concerns about his ability to serve the Board of Education since he is currently in the stages of a felony charge accusation, and if he were to be charged, I am not aware of what his sentence may be, but it could very well hinder his ability to serve on the board, Marquay said. The senior said he is also concerned about the state's current legal requirements that one must meet in order to serve on a school board. The only mention of criminal background is that a school board member cannot have been convicted of committing a sexual offense against a child. Currently, so many individuals could be convicted of some very serious crimes, including murder and kidnapping, and the current background check done statewide would not detect these changes, Marquay said. I think in those instances, specifically, it would be very inappropriate to allow those individuals access to any school grounds, let alone represent the safety of the students. During his public comment, Marquay said he believes new guidelines need to be established statewide. It is my belief that the following be implemented not only by our school district, but at the state level as well, he said. Individuals with any active warrants of any variety should not be eligible to run for board or be allowed access to any school grounds. If an off-campus officer discovers an active warrant, appropriate action should be taken by the department they represent. An individual needs to receive a verdict on any impending felony cases before they can apply to run. If a running candidate receives a pending felony charge, they need to sort out their charge and receive a verdict prior to election, or they must drop from the running. Nonviolent felony convictions should make a person ineligible to run for a school board position if committed within the past 5 to 10 years of their application. Violent felony conviction should make a person permanently ineligible to run for school board positions. Marquay said he feels the current regulations in place in the state of Colorado are falling short of the bare minimum. I hope to take this matter up the chain of command as far as I can take it to change state law regarding school board candidate eligibility, Marquay said. I hope to be a student voice fighting for students statewide, and if I get lucky, other states would hopefully follow. Recall would be heavy lift. Citizens on social media have brought up the idea of a potential recall. Superintendent Joanne Polzin said in the event of a recall of a board member, the district will follow the law and procedure listed on the Colorado Secretary of State website. The website states, an elected official must hold office for 6 months before a recall can be attempted. Additionally, the Uniform Election Code of 1992, CRS 1-12-105, states, a petition to recall a school district officer shall be signed by eligible electors of the school district equal in numbers to at least 40% of the entire vote cast at the last preceding election for all candidates for the school district director position occupied by the incumbent sought to be recalled. However, it goes on to say, in no case shall the number required for recall be less than 10% of eligible electors qualified to vote in the most recent biennial school election, except that no more than 15,000 signatures is required. Englewood has roughly 22,000 registered voters. And while the school district is a little smaller than the city boundary, a 10% requirement would mean around 2,000 valid signatures would be needed for a recall petition sufficient to trigger an election. When he's spoken to other students about the state qualifications for school board candidates, Marquez said his peers agree that this is a concerning issue that needs to be addressed. Marquez said in addition to being a student journalist, he is a student body treasurer, and he is involved in Pirate TV, The Pirateer, and Yearbook. Additionally, Marquez said during his advocacy of this issue, he will not be writing or reporting on anything regarding Williams or the school board while working for The Pirateer. For more information on the student perspective of the matter and for a more in-depth editorial written by Marquez, residents can click here to read the Pirateer article, Controversy Ahead for the Englewood School Board, written by editor and sophomore Serenity Gambrell. Centennial leaders host community event in District 1. Centennial residents, city officials, and Littleton Public Schools leaders covered a breadth of issues during a District 1 meeting, including changes to local leadership, pedestrian safety, and challenges facing the school district. Held November 28th at the recently opened Centennial YMCA Center of Generations, the meeting was hosted by Centennial District 1 Council members Candace Moon and Robin Carnes. Residents raised concerns. Two parents of students attending Beauty Gaskill Elementary, a Littleton public school located in Centennial, raised concerns about the intersection of East Arapaho Road and South Franklin Street, saying it is a dangerous road that families have to cross when walking or biking to school. One of the parents said she wants to reiterate how unsafe the intersection is, asking the city for any updates on upcoming changes to increase safety. Anna Bunce, a Centennial traffic engineer, said the city plans to update the intersection. A challenge is that the intersection has overhead power lines adjacent to it, and that would constrain the city's opportunities to do things like make sure the new traffic signal has lighting, she said. To address that, the city is working with Xcel Energy to move the overhead lines underground in advance of reconstructioning the intersection, she said. We will be advancing the design in 2024, Bunt said. It is continuing to move forward. Potential changes for the new traffic signal design includes changing out some of the left turn and right turn displays, she said. The flashing yellow arrow displays, which everyone has seen for 15 years now for left turns, we are anticipating phasing those in for right turns as well, she said. Another potential change is that if somebody pushes the button to cross the road, the traffic signal will hold a red arrow across the movement for the duration of the pedestrian crossing interval, she said. A benefit of that method is that it will not restrict a car's turning movement unless a pedestrian is actually present in crossing the road. That is going to be one of our biggest safety implications moving forward, she said. We're hoping that also will teach drivers over time that if you're seeing that red arrow, it's for a reason. It's for a safety reason. Some residents asked what can be done in the short term as they wait for changes to be made at the intersection. One person pointed out that a Littleton Public School student recently died after being hit by a car while biking to school, saying they don't want to see that happen again. Superintendent Todd Lampert said the school district works with different municipalities and pointed out that the Littleton City Council held a study session to discuss bicycle and pedestrian safety. Please know, we have that same sense of urgency, Lampert said. We have some plans to be out before the winter break, even to do some evaluations, and then we'll start in earnest making changes that we think need to be made. Those interested in learning more about Centennial's Public Works Department and or submitting comments, questions, and requests for the department can visit bit.ly ly/CEN-Public Works. Leaders address staffing enrollment challenges. As part of the district meeting, Lambert, joined by Board of Education President Angela Christensen and Vice President Andrew Graham, gave a presentation on what is happening in the school district and current challenges it faces, such as staffing. "We have shortages for positions in all areas," Lambert said. "For example, special education teachers and bus drivers are highly needed," he said. "It's a challenge. We compete with industry. We compete with others," he said. "We're trying to do the very best we can to cultivate and grow our talent." A priority for the Board of Education is to stay competitive with compensation, Christensen said. "Last year, we were able to raise teacher pay. It's still not great, but it's an improvement," she said. Another issue facing the school district is its enrollment numbers. Lambert said the school district's total enrollment is currently 13,296 students. "Our enrollment continues to have a slow decline," Lambert said. "That presents some challenges for us." Lambert said there are a lot of ways to go about dealing with sporadic enrollment patterns. "Please know that we are not satisfied with that. We believe that we can turn that down," he said. "This year has been the slowest decline we've had in the last 3 years, and that's a really good indicator for us." Saying farewell. It was Councilmember Moon's final district meeting as a council member, as her term is about to end. During the meeting, officials thanked Moon for her contributions to the city. "I have learned so much from you and your perspective," Councilmember Karn said to Moon. "I just thank you, personally, for sharing a different perspective, but one that was so helpful and essential for our city." Residents thanked Moon for speaking on their behalf at meetings, sharing knowledge about the history of the city and serving others before herself. "I really appreciate you all having the confidence to allow me to serve you for the last 8 years," Moon said. "I truly take into heart that I serve you. I don't serve myself." Council members introduced Amy Tharp, the newly elected District 1 council member who will be taking Moon's seat in early January. "Thank you all, the people of District 1, for supporting me, for believing in me, for voting for me," Tharp said. "I'm just absolutely thrilled and honored that you would do that for me." Tharp has worked in education for more than 30 years, teaching in local schools like Highland Elementary and Field Elementary. Although she has retired, she still substitute teaches. "I wanted to thank the leadership and to let you know how important Littleton Public Schools is in our community, and how their guidance for me, their training, their leadership has helped me to get here as a leader now in Centennial on the City Council," Tharp said. Artisanship and eternity. Local glass artists have spent years on their craft. By Chris Cobrill. Starting into a kiln glowing orange at 2,350 degrees, an artist armed with thick leather gloves holds a fragile piece of molten glass at the end of a steel rod. This is the point where creativity, talent, and inspiration combine to create a one-of-a-kind piece of glass never to be duplicated. Sand and silica are the main components. Soda ash and lime are combined to the mixture as raw ingredients. Corey Silverman of the Furnace, a glassworks in Lakewood, said. "Industrial glass that's made in a factory by machines works in a different way versus what we do by hand." The Furnace is a glass workshop that dedicates 90% of its production to retail sales, according to Silverman. Thousands of ornaments will be handmade and shipped from this location. I have galleries all around the country. I've got over 100 galleries that buy my work, Silverman said during a recent interview at his small production facility. I sell to magazines. I sell to corporate gift companies. I sell to a lot of retail buyers through our store here, as well as Etsy, so we have a wide variety of customers. The months leading up to the holidays are the busiest time of year for Silverman and his co-owner and wife, Leanne. Silverman started blowing glass objects, art, more than 30 years ago, he said. He's still learning. You start with a clear glass that's molten out of the furnace at 2,100 degrees. Gather it up on your blowpipe and apply a color called frit, Silverman said. You then reheat the glass, shape it, and put a bubble into it after you put a pattern into it with your color. Once you've got your shape the way you want it, you let it stabilize, you finish it off and put it in the oven, about 500 degrees for as many as 12 hours. The furnace is not only a commercial facility employing less than a dozen production and distribution assistants, it's a learning environment offering introductory instruction to anyone with a desire to learn the craft. You learn something every time you walk through the door, Silverman said about the classes. However, patience, practice, and commitment are prerequisites. People ask me, how long will it take me to get good, Silverman said. I like to tell people it's a 10-year commitment before you're really good at this. You have to be very committed to it. Yet each piece is completely original to the artist. The goal is to make products that will not be like anything you've ever seen before, Silverman said. Cremation glass art offers ashes in eternal suspension. In an unassuming garage in Greeley, an artist incorporates the cremated ashes of loved ones and even pets into molded and forged glass pieces that are incomparable. For the cremation art, I do believe that working with human ashes is what hits my heart and soul the most, said Tiffany Cohen with Red Manx Studio. During a recent visit with the artist, Cohen said to fold, curl, and mold a small piece of molten glass in a 2,150-degree gas-fired kiln. The idea of incorporating precious ashes within the glass was conceived in 2009, Cohen said. The epiphany was achieved with a very personal story. In 2008, Cohen's mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. Mom's cancer journey and watching her and everybody in that chemo room teetering on death hit me, Cohen said. Mom came out of it, but there's a lot of people in that chemo room that didn't live through their experiences. If I can help families get through it with something more special than a box on a mantle, then that's what I want to do, especially with the children's pieces, Cohen said. Here, the customer, their story, and vision are incorporated in each unique color selection and swirl of soft molten glass. Cohen welcomes each buyer to be part of the process and witness the creation of the unique glass piece as it's conceived and shaped in her small garage. Nearly a dozen times over, Cohen heated and shaped the glass at the end of a metal pipe. Cohen uses a unique tool made of wet wood, which is created by several species of bacteria that enter a tree through wounds, keeping the wood malleable, which is perfect against the blazing hot temperatures of the molten glass. The soft, cylindrical shape of the wood creates the rounded edges with continuous turning of the delicate glass. Cohen spends at least 18 hours repeating the process of heating, shaping, molding, and cooling each glass piece. In the end, each customer is presented with a keepsake unlike any in existence, just like their loved one. Douglas County Health Department warns residents to check pantries for recalled applesauce. The Federal Food and Drug Administration announced it is investigating elevated lead levels in some cinnamon applesauce and apple puree pouches. Pointing to brands that include ones sold through retailers including Amazon, Dollar Tree, and other online outlets, according to the FDA's website. The Douglas County Health Department has visited retailers in the county to ensure products are no longer stocked, but the department urges you to check your pantry. Products affected by a food safety recall include Wanabana apple cinnamon fruit puree pouches, including 3 packs. Schnucks brand cinnamon-flavored applesauce pouches and variety pack. And Weiss brand cinnamon applesauce pouches. See more information in the Wanabana Company's recall announcement at tinyurl.com/recall-announce. Wanabana is sold nationally through multiple retailers including Amazon, Dollar Tree, and other online outlets. Schnucks products are only available at Schnucks and Eat Well Markets grocery stores, and Weiss brand pouches are only sold at Weiss grocery stores, both located outside of Colorado, according to a Douglas County news release. Locally, the Douglas County Health Department investigates reports of elevated lead levels. To date, none of its investigations have been associated with this recall, the December 12th release said. The recalled products are potentially associated with childhood lead poisoning cases across the country, according to the release. People who have these products at home should discard them. Children who have eaten the products recently should get a blood lead test, the county's release said. Most children have no obvious immediate symptoms. Parents and caretakers should consult a health care provider if they suspect a child may have been exposed to lead. Lead is toxic to humans and can affect people of any age or health status. Protecting children from exposure to lead is particularly important because they are more susceptible to lead toxicity, the FDA's website says. Short-term exposure to lead, according to the FDA, could result in the following symptoms: headache, abdominal pain or colic, vomiting, or anemia. Longer-term exposure, according to the FDA, could result in the following additional symptoms: irritability, lethargy, fatigue, muscle aches or muscle prickling or burning, constipation, difficulty concentrating, or muscular weakness, tremor, or weight loss. See more information and updates on the investigation on the FDA's website at tinyurl.com/FDA updates. Cherry Creek superintendent addresses racist videos in letter to families. In a December 13th letter to Cherry Creek families, Superintendent Chris Smith addressed videos that have been circulating online of students saying racial slurs and hate speech. He said, in part, that he wanted to address a societal crisis that is impacting our schools. In recent weeks, we have observed instances of students using hurtful and offensive language, including racial slurs, Smith said. This is not unique to the Cherry Creek School District. On November 15th, officials with the Rocky Mountain NAACP and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Colorado Holiday Commission held a press conference after the spread of a video showing a West Middle School student expressing hatred against black people. A few weeks after the press conference, the Rocky Mountain NAACP said there was another racist video being shared that shows two Cherry Creek students repeatedly using the N-word. Parents in the Cherry Creek School District asked the school board on December 11th for more transparent communication and clearer disciplinary policies for incidents of racism and discrimination. I want to be clear. The use of hateful language, including the N-word, is unacceptable, Smith said in his letter. Recently, we have had instances of racist videos that were created off campus and caused disruption of the learning environment. Students engaging in this type of behavior have and will face consequences, he said. These can range from restorative practices up to suspension and/or expulsion from school. Smith encouraged parents to talk to their children about not using racist language anywhere, including on social media. As a school district, we cannot solve societal problems alone, but we will continue to take steps to ensure our schools are safe places for all, he said. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.